Welcome to Pilgrim Radio's Reader's Choice. We invite you to join us for the next 30 minutes as together we open the pages of a good book. And now, here's your reader with more information.
Well, hello again. I'm Pamela Fitch, and it's good to have you with us as we continue reading the book Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis. It's published by HarperCollins in the year 1980. And I will be picking up where we left off on page 18. But first, you might be interested to know that yesterday C.S. Lewis was talking about morality, and he was making two points about morality. So I'll review the last paragraph that we read. These, then, are the two points I wanted to make. First, that human beings all over the earth have this curious idea that they ought to behave in a certain way and cannot really get rid of it. Secondly, that they do not, in fact, behave in that way. They know the law of nature. They break it. These two facts are the foundation of all clear thinking about ourselves and the universe we live in. And with that, I'll return to where we finished yesterday. There is no difference of moral principle here. The difference is simply about matter of fact. It may be a great advance in knowledge not to believe in witches. There is no moral advance in not executing them when you do not think they are there. You would not call a man humane for ceasing to set mouse traps if he did so because he believed there were no mice in the house. And now we come to chapter 3, The Reality of the Law. I now go back to what I said at the end of the first chapter, that there were two odd things about the human race. First, that they were haunted by the idea of a sort of behavior they ought to practice, what you might call fair play, or decency, or morality, or the law of nature. Second, that they did not, in fact, do so. Now, some of you may wonder why I called this odd. It may seem to you the most natural thing in the world. In particular, you may have thought I was rather hard on the human race. After all, you may say, what I call breaking the law of right and wrong or of nature only means that people are not perfect. And why on earth should I expect them to be? That would be a good answer if what I was trying to do was to fix the exact amount of blame which is due to us for not behaving as we expect others to behave. But that is not my job at all. I'm not concerned at present with blame. I'm trying to find out truth. And from that point of view, the very idea of something being imperfect, of its not being what it ought to be, has certain consequences. If you take a thing like a stone or a tree, it is what it is, and there seems no sense in saying it ought to have been otherwise. Of course, you may say a stone is the wrong shape if you want to use it for a rockery, or that a tree is a bad tree because it does not give you as much shade as you expected. But all you mean is that the stone or the tree does not happen to be convenient for some purpose of your own. You are not, except as a joke, blaming them for that. You really know that, given the weather and the soil, the tree could not have been any different. What we, from our point of view, call a bad tree is obeying the laws of its nature just as much as a good one. Now, have you noticed what follows? It follows that what we usually call the laws of nature, the way weather works on a tree, for example, may not really be laws in the strict sense, but only in a manner of speaking. When you say that falling stones always obey the law of gravitation, is not this much the same as saying that the law only means what stones always do? You do not really think that when a stone is let go, it suddenly remembers that it is under orders to fall to the ground. You only mean that, in fact, it does fall. In other words, you cannot be sure that there's anything over and above the facts themselves, any law about what ought to happen as distinct from what does happen. The laws of nature, as applied to stones or trees, may only mean what nature in fact does. But if you turn to the law of human nature, the law of decent behavior, it is a different matter. That law certainly does not mean what human beings in fact do, for as I said before, many of them do not obey this law at all, and none of them obey it completely. The law of gravity tells you what stones do if you drop them, but the law of human nature tells you what human beings ought to do and do not. In other words, when you are dealing with humans, something else comes in above and beyond the actual facts. You have the facts, how men do behave, and you also have something else, how they ought to behave. In the rest of the universe, there need not be anything but the facts. Electrons and molecules behave in a certain way, and certain results follow, and that may be the whole story. But men behave in a certain way, and that is not the whole story, for all the time you know that they ought to behave differently. Now, this is really so peculiar that one is tempted to try to explain it away. For instance, we might try to make out that when you say a man ought not to act as he does, you only mean the same as when you say that a stone is the wrong shape, namely, that what he's doing happens to be inconvenient to you. But that is simply untrue. A man occupying the corner seat in the train because he got there first, and a man who slipped into it while my back was turned and removed my bag, are both equally inconvenient. But I blame the second man and do not blame the first. I'm not angry, except perhaps for a moment before I come to my senses, with a man who trips me up by accident. I'm angry with a man who tries to trip me up, even if he does not succeed. Yet the first has hurt me, and the second has not. Sometimes the behavior which I call bad is not inconvenient to me at all, but the very opposite. In war, each side may find a traitor on the other side very useful, but though they use him and pay him, they regard him as human vermin. So you cannot say that what we call decent behavior in others is simply the behavior that happens to be useful to us. And as for decent behavior in ourselves, I suppose it is pretty obvious that it does not mean the behavior that pays. It means things like being content with 30 shillings when you might have got 3 pounds, doing schoolwork honestly when it would be easy to cheat, leaving a girl alone when you would like to make love to her, staying in dangerous places when you would rather go somewhere safer, keeping promises you would rather not keep, and telling the truth even when it makes you look a fool. Some people say that though decent conduct does not mean what pays each particular person at a particular moment, still it means what pays the human race as a whole, and that consequently there's no mystery about it. Human beings, after all, have some sense. They see that you cannot have any real safety or happiness except in a society where everyone plays fair, and it is because they see this that they try to behave decently. Now, of course, it is perfectly true that safety and happiness can only come from individuals, classes, and nations being honest and fair and kind to each other. It is one of the most important truths in the world. But as an explanation of why we feel as we do about right and wrong, it just misses the point. If we ask, why ought I to be unselfish, and you reply, because it is good for society, we may then ask, why should I care what's good for society except when it happens to pay me personally? And then you will have to say, because you ought to be unselfish, which simply brings us back to where we started. You are saying what is true, but you are not getting any further. If a man asks, what was the point of playing football? It would not be much good saying, in order to score goals. For trying to score goals is the game itself, not the reason for the game. And you would really only be saying that football was football, which is true, but not worth saying. In the same way, if a man asks, "What is the point of behaving decently?" it is no good replying, "In order to benefit society." For trying to benefit society, in other words, being unselfish, for society, after all, only means other people, is one of the things decent behavior consists in. All you are really saying is that decent behavior is decent behavior. You would have said just as much if you had stopped at the statement, "Men ought to be unselfish." And that is where I do stop. Men ought to be unselfish, ought to be fair. Not that men are unselfish, not that they like being unselfish, but that they ought to be. The moral law, or law of human nature, is not simply a fact about human behavior in the same way as the law of gravitation is, or maybe simply a fact about how heavy objects behave. On the other hand, it is not a mere fancy, for we cannot get rid of the idea. And most of the things we say and think about men would be reduced to nonsense if we did. And it is not simply a statement about how we should like men to behave for our own convenience. For the behavior we call bad or unfair is not exactly the same as the behavior we find inconvenient, and may even be the opposite. Consequently, this rule of right and wrong, or law of human nature, or whatever you call it, must somehow or other be a real thing, a thing that is really there, not made up by ourselves. And yet, it is not a fact in the ordinary sense, in the same way as our actual behavior is a fact. It begins to look as if we shall have to admit that there is more than one kind of reality, that in this particular case, there is something above and beyond the ordinary facts of men's behavior, and yet quite definitely real, a real law, which none of us made, but which we find pressing on us. And now we come to chapter 4, what lies behind the law? Let us sum up what we have reached so far. In the case of stones and trees and things of that sort, what we call the laws of nature may not be anything except a way of speaking. When you say that nature is governed by certain laws, this may only mean that nature does, in fact, behave in a certain way. The so-called laws may not be anything real, anything above and beyond the actual facts which we observe. But in the case of man, we saw that this will not do. The law of human nature, or of right and wrong, must be something above and beyond the actual facts of human behavior. In this case, besides the actual facts, you have something else, a real law which we did not invent, and which we know we ought to obey. I now want to consider what this tells us about the universe we live in. Ever since men were able to think, they have been wondering what this universe really is and how it came to be there. And very roughly, two views have been held. First, there is what is called the materialist view. People who take that view think that matter and space just happen to exist and always have existed, nobody knows why, and that the matter, behaving in certain fixed ways, has just happened by a sort of fluke to produce creatures like ourselves who are able to think. By one chance in a thousand, something hit our sun and made it produce the planets, and by another thousandth chance, the chemicals necessary for life and the right temperature occurred on one of these planets, and so some of the matter on this earth came alive, and then, by a very long series of chances, the living creatures developed into things like us. The other view is the religious view. According to it, what is behind the universe is more like a mind than it is like anything else we know. That is to say, it is conscious and has purposes and prefers one thing to another. And on this view, it made the universe, partly for purposes we do not know, but partly at any rate, in order to produce creatures like itself. I mean, like itself to the extent of having minds. Please do not think that one of these views was held a long time ago, and that the other has gradually taken its place. Wherever there have been thinking men, both views turn up. And note this too. You cannot find out which view is the right one by science in the ordinary sense. Science works by experiments. It watches how things behave. Every scientific statement in the long run, however complicated it looks, really means something like, I pointed the telescope to such and such a part of the sky at 2:20 a.m. on January 15th and saw so-and-so. Or, I put some of this stuff in a pot and heated it to such and such a temperature, and it did so-and-so. Do not think I'm saying anything against science. I'm only saying what its job is. And the more scientific a man is, the more I believe he would agree with me that this is the job of science, and a very useful and necessary job it is, too. But why anything comes to be there at all, and whether there is anything behind the things science observes, something of a different kind, this is not a scientific question. If there is something behind, then either it will have to remain altogether unknown to men, or else make itself known in some different way. The statement that there is any such thing and the statement that there is no such thing are neither of them statements that science can make, and real scientists do not usually make them. It is usually the journalists and popular novelists who have picked up a few odds and ends of half-baked science from textbooks who go in for them. After all, it is really a matter of common sense. Supposing science ever became complete so that it knew every single thing in the whole universe, is it not plain that the questions, why is there a universe? Why does it go on as it does? Has it any meaning? Would remain just as they were. Now, the position would be quite hopeless but for this. There is one thing, and only one, in the whole universe which we know more about than we could learn from external observation. That one thing is man. We do not merely observe men, we are men. In this case, we have, so to speak, inside information. We are in the know. And because of that, we know that men find themselves under a moral law, which they did not make and cannot quite forget, even when they try, and which they know they ought to obey. Notice the following point. Anyone studying man from the outside, as we study electricity or cabbages, not knowing our language and consequently not able to get any inside knowledge from us, but merely observing what we did, would never get the slightest evidence that we had this moral law. How could he? For his observations would only show what we did. And the moral law is about what we ought to do. In the same way, if there were anything above or behind the observed facts, in the case of stones or the weather, we, by studying them from outside, could never hope to discover it. The position of the question then is like this. We want to know whether the universe simply happens to be what it is for no reason, or whether there is a power behind it that makes it what it is. Since that power, if it exists, would be not one of the observed facts, but a reality which makes them, no mere observation of the facts can find it. There is only one case in which we can know whether there is anything more, namely our own case. And in that one case, we find there is. Or, put it the other way round, if there was a controlling power outside the universe, it could not show itself to us as one of the facts inside the universe, no more than the architect of a house could actually be a wall or staircase or fireplace in that house. The only way which we could expect it to show itself would be inside ourselves as an influence or a command trying to get us to behave in a certain way. And that is just what we do find inside ourselves. Surely this ought to arouse our suspicions. In the only case where you can expect to get an answer, the answer turns out to be yes. And in the other cases where you do not get an answer, you see why you do not. Suppose someone asked me, when I see a man in blue uniform going down the street, leaving little paper packets at each house, why I suppose that they contain letters. I should reply, because whenever he leaves a similar little packet for me, I find it does contain a letter. And if he then objected, but you've never seen all these letters which you think the other people are getting, I should say, of course not. And I shouldn't expect to, because they're not addressed to me. I'm explaining the packets I'm not allowed to open by the ones I am allowed to open. It is the same about this question. The only packet I am allowed to open is man. When I do, especially when I open that particular man called myself, I find that I do not exist on my own, that I am under a law, that somebody or something wants me to behave in a certain way. I do not, of course, think that if I could get inside a stone or a tree, I should find exactly the same thing, just as I do not think all the other people in the street get the same letters as I do. I should expect, for instance, to find that the stone had to obey the law of gravity, that whereas the sender of the letters merely tells me to obey the law of my human nature, he compels the stone to obey the laws of its stony nature. But I should expect to find that there was, so to speak, a sender of letters in both cases, a power behind the facts, a director, a guide. Do not think I'm going faster than I really am. I'm not yet within 100 miles of the God of Christian theology. All I have got to is a something which is directing the universe and which appears in me as a law urging me to do right and making me feel responsible and uncomfortable when I do wrong. I think we have to assume it is more like a mind than it is like anything else we know, because after all, the only other thing we know is matter, and you can hardly imagine a bit of matter giving instructions. But of course, it need not be very like a mind, still less like a person. In the next chapter, we shall see if we can find out anything more about it. But one word of warning. There has been a great deal of soft soap talked about God for the last 100 years. That is not what I am offering. You can cut all that out. Note, in order to keep this section short enough, when it was given on the air, I mentioned only the materialist view and the religious view. But to be complete, I ought to mention the in-between view called life force philosophy, or creative evolution, or emergent evolution. The wittiest expositions of it come in the works of Bernard Shaw, but the most profound ones in those of Bergson. People who hold this view say that the small variations by which life on this planet evolved from the lowest forms to man were not due to chance, but to the striving or purposiveness of a life force. When people say this, we must ask them whether by life force they mean something with a mind or not. If they do, then a mind bringing life into existence and leading it to perfection is really a God. And their view is thus identical with the religious. If they do not, then what is the sense in saying that something without a mind strives or has purposes? This seems to me fatal to their view. One reason why many people find creative evolution so attractive is that it gives, one, much of the emotional comfort of believing in God and none of the less pleasant consequences. When you are feeling fit and the sun is shining and you do not want to believe that the whole universe is a mere mechanical dance of atoms, it is nice to be able to think of this great mysterious force rolling on through the centuries and carrying you on its crest. If, on the other hand, you want to do something rather shabby, the life force, being only a blind force with no morals and no mind, will never interfere with you like that troublesome God we learned about when we were children. The life force is a sort of tame God. You can switch it on when you want, but it will not bother you. All the thrills of religion and none of the cost. Is the life force the greatest achievement of wishful thinking the world has seen yet? And now we begin with chapter 5. It's called We Have Cause to Be Uneasy. I ended my last chapter with the idea that in the moral law, somebody or something from beyond the material universe was actually getting at us. And I expect when I reached that point, some of you felt a certain annoyance. You may even have thought that I had played a trick on you, that I had been carefully wrapping up to look like philosophy what turns out to be one more religious jaw. You may have felt you were ready to listen to me as long as you thought I had anything new to say. But if it turns out to be only religion, well, the world has tried that, and you cannot put the clock back. If anyone is feeling that way, I should like to say three things to him. First, as to putting the clock back, would you think I was joking if I said that you can put a clock back and that if the clock is wrong, it is often a very sensible thing to do? But I would rather get away from that whole idea of clocks. We all want progress. But progress means getting nearer to the place where you want to be. And if you've taken a wrong turning, then to go forward does not get you any nearer. If you are on the wrong road, progress means doing an about turn and walking back to the right road. And in that case, the man who turns back soonest is the most progressive man. We've all seen this when doing arithmetic. When I've started a sum the wrong way, the sooner I admit this and go back and start again, the faster I shall get on. There's nothing progressive about being pig-headed and refusing to admit a mistake. And I think if you look at the present state of the world, it is pretty plain that humanity has been making some big mistake. We are on the wrong road. And if that is so, we must go back. Going back is the quickest way on. Then secondly, this has not yet turned exactly into a religious jaw. We've not yet got as far as the God of any actual religion, still less the God of that particular religion called Christianity. We've only got as far as a somebody or something behind the moral law. We are not taking anything from the Bible or the churches. We are trying to see what we can find out about this somebody on our own steam. And I want to make it quite clear that what we find out on our own steam is something that gives us a shock. And on that note, it's time for us to close. We'll stop here today on page 36, reading Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis, published by HarperCollins in 1980. Thanks so much for joining me, and God bless you until we meet again.
You've been listening to Reader's Choice, featuring good books from the Christian classics to the latest releases in half-hour installments. To find out about other programs on Pilgrim Radio, visit our website at pilgrimradio.com or request a free program guide by emailing info@pilgrimradio.com. And join us again next time for Reader's Choice.